you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, in for Rob Ferret. Coming up, cities, Indian nations, and countries around the world have given nature and specific natural resources legal rights. We look at how it works, whether it has stood up to legal challenges, and whether it's a viable tool for protecting the environment. First, the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative got started in 2010 as a way for federal funds to pay for cleanup efforts around the Great Lakes. Since then, it's funded more than 4,000 projects dealing with things like invasive species and habitat restoration. But the program has also seen its funding drop by nearly $200 million. Now, a new piece of bipartisan legislation is looking to change that. U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin is a Democrat representing Wisconsin. She's one of five lawmakers to introduce the bill. Senator Baldwin, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Can you give us a Great Lakes Restoration Initiative 101? What does this program do?
This program allows local projects that are partnerships between nonprofit conservancy groups and local governments, and certainly supported by Great Lake Restoration Initiative funds, to clean up our Great Lakes. And there's lots of different projects that are undertaken to do just that, whether it's trying to rid the tributaries of, toxic pollutants, or cleaning up the shoreland, and all of this with the aim of cleaner water, higher water quality, combating invasive species, and restoring polluted sites to protect and preserve our Great Lakes for generations to come.
And are there some specific efforts here in Wisconsin that have received funding through this program that you can point to?
There are dozens and dozens of projects that have happened in Wisconsin, on Lake Superior, on Lake Michigan, and also a little bit more inland with the rivers that flow into the Great Lakes, because oftentimes those are the areas of greatest concern. Also, the wildlife habitat that relies on clean shorelands are a focus.
And this particular version of the initiative would expand the funding significantly. What are some of the things that you hope will be able to be funded that you wouldn't be able to without the increase?
Well, so the measure gradually increases the funding over the next several years. We are so thrilled that this has bipartisan support in both the House and the Senate, that it is really teamwork among the Great Lakes senators and the Great Lakes members of the House of Representatives. I would say that every state has and submits more projects than can possibly be funded given the financial constraints of this program right now. And so it will be consistent with a lot of the activities that we have seen in the past, but we'll be able to clean up more polluted sites, look at having a larger scale effort to combat invasive species. You know, I think about the damage that something like the Asian carp might have if they ever get into our Great Lakes water basin. We want to be way ahead of that threat because it would be devastating to our Great Lakes environment and economy. But there are things that are already past, like zebra mussels and other invasive species. We want to get a leg up to the extent that we can to prevent anything that would have a harmful effect.
We're talking with U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin. She's a Democrat representing Wisconsin, and we are talking about her efforts on behalf of the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative. And Senator Baldwin, you are hoping to see an increase in spending of $175 million over time. President Trump has tried to cut funding for the program three times. Do you have a sense of whether the administration is going to be open to preserving current levels of funding, let alone this increase?
You are correct that the administration and the president in particular has proposed enormous cuts to the Great Lake Restoration Initiative in the first couple of years of his administration. It would have been devastating. And I think what happened is that he heard back from Great Lakes residents, business people whose businesses depend upon the Great Lakes. He heard from elected officials from the Great Lakes State. And very recently, it appears that he has changed his tune on support of the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative. You know, I think that perhaps this is one of the times where it's an advantage that the Upper Midwest and the Great Lakes states are so politically impactful. He may be eyeing that, or may have simply just begun to understand that these are absolutely essential initiatives to the greatest freshwater source in the world.
And briefly, before we let you go, Senator, some have made the case that it would be better to put this funding towards a few very large, perhaps more impactful projects instead of dividing it up among hundreds of different projects every year. How would you respond to that?
Well, I believe that the biggest bang for the buck is actually looking at across the Great Lakes Basin, at all of the sources of contaminants and pollution, the factors that are resulting in more frequent algal blooms. There are a couple of major projects that I think should be reviewed for Great Lakes Restoration Initiative funding. In particular, I would look at the effort in Illinois to prevent Asian carp from entering the Great Lakes Basin through a particular riverway. We have all of us, no matter what state, Great Lakes state we're from, been working together to try to make sure that that never happens. And that is something that's going to require a larger engineering monetary commitment. But by and large, I think that it's much more cost-effective to be spreading this funding out across many states. It is one of those programs that leverages additional funding. And that is always exciting when a federal tax dollar can leverage private investment, volunteer labor on these projects, and nonprofit organizations really oftentimes in the lead.
Well, thank you so much for spending time with us today, Senator Baldwin.
My pleasure.
That was Wisconsin's Democratic U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin. She joined us to talk about a new piece of legislation she introduced with other lawmakers from both parties. Its aim is to increase funding for Great Lakes cleanup efforts. Coming up, we talk with two Wisconsin authors about a book documenting the 1958 Colfax tornado. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Coming up, in 1958, an F5 tornado struck Colfax, Wisconsin, leaving death and destruction in its wake. We talk with two Wisconsinites about the history of this event and the resilience of the community. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with the history of an iconic Wisconsin treat.
When you see a carton of ice cream from Babcock Hall Dairy Plant, you'll notice it's not particularly flashy. It's red, white, and black. Bucky Badger appears next to a sticker that tells you the flavor. Maybe it's Blue Moon, Orange Custard Chocolate Chip, or Mocha Macchiato. But does it really matter what the carton looks like? As the cliche goes, it's what's inside that counts. The Babcock ice cream carton is one of the many items included in the Wisconsin 101 Project, which tells the state's history through objects. Jane Jensky visited the Babcock plant to learn more about the importance of the beloved ice cream.
The Babcock Dairy Store on UW-Madison's campus is a place you can find one of Wisconsin's most treasured ice creams. Glinda Jones is an employee at the dairy store. She loves selling and eating Babcock ice cream. and has been doing it for 16 years.
And my favorite ice cream is chocolate peanut butter.
Students, faculty, and ice cream lovers crave Babcock ice cream, to the point where they will drive from across the state to buy a gallon of their favorite flavor. Babcock Dairy Plant Supervisor Raymond Van Cleve explains this phenomenon.
We've got people all the way from northern Wisconsin that drive down and pick up ice cream in the summertime, you know, once a week, you know. They come down with big ice cream coolers and stuff and pick up ice cream and take it back up north. So, but yeah, it's always good to hear stories about people that come in, you know, and say, Babcock, we got to have Babcock.
Inside the dairy plant, students studying food science can be found making ice cream and cheese.
First and foremost, we're an educational facility.
Van Cleve says UW-Madison isn't looking to get rich off of Babcock ice cream, cheese, and milk. They simply want to educate students and advise nearby small farms and dairy factories. The ice cream's recipe was created in the 1950s and hasn't changed since. And this plant looks a lot like how it did when it opened in 1951. It's filled with large metal vats of milk, pasteurizers, and ice cream churning tanks.
I believe this is pretty close to the footprint of what everything was originally, yeah. A lot of this place hasn't really been remodeled or hasn't been retouched with a lot of things since then. Some of these pieces of equipment are 50, 60 years old.
Although Babcock isn't the largest dairy plant, their history is among the oldest, starting in the late 1800s. Babcock plant gets its name from UW-Madison professor Stephen Babcock, who helped develop the first butterfat test in 1890. With the butterfat test, consumers knew that the milk they purchased was high quality and safe to drink. UW food science professor emeritus Robert Bradley says the butterfat test revolutionized the dairy industry.
This is Babcock Hall, and his first centrifuge is down in the front lobby, if you wanted to take a look at that. And the centrifuge is a means of putting the denser product on the bottom and the lighter product on the top, which would be the fat column.
And Bradley says Babcock ice cream is on the denser side.
It's a top quality ice cream. We haven't cut corners.
Because of Babcock's invention, Wisconsin not only became known as America's Dairyland, but helped his namesake ice cream become iconic.
That story about Babcock ice cream came from Jane Jensky, a UW-Madison student working on an internship this summer for Wisconsin Life and Wisconsin 101, which tells the history of the state through objects. Hey, Wisconsin Life fans, we are giving our website a facelift, and we'd love to hear from you how we can make it better. Send us an email to wisconsinlife@wpr.org to let us know if you'd like to share your thoughts on our website. That's wisconsinlife@wpr.org. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every single Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast feed. And find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Now, one of the worst tornadoes in state history ripped through the village of Colfax on June 4, 1958, leaving damage and loss in its wake. But when we look back at that time, it isn't just a history of death and destruction after a dangerous weather event. It's also the power of community and healing. Troy and Michelle Knutson are the authors of the book, The 1958 Colfax Tornado, which is part of the series Images of America. Troy is a lifelong resident of Colfax and one of the town's historians, and Michelle teaches history at New Richmond High School and is originally from Dresser. Troy and Michelle, thank you so much for joining us from our studio in Eau Claire.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
And let's talk about that tornado. Michelle, can you set the scene for us? It's June 4th, 1958. What do we know about how that day started?
All of the stories talk about how muggy it was and how heavy the weather was. And, you know, we have so many survivors in town in Colfax who share stories and share pictures. And it wasn't just Colfax either. It started near Baldwin, and it covered from Baldwin down to Chippewa. And, you know, people watched this happen because the weather was just so severe, and you could see it from miles away, what was going to happen. And even the young ones, the people that were kids, just remembered the heaviness and knowing that something was brewing.
And I remember also there was, I believe, a couple of young men working in a barn, and they felt this incredible charge of static electricity.
The electricity, also just the pressure of it, too, as it came in, and just knowing that something wasn't quite right, but then just not having a lot of time to seek any sort of shelter.
And Troy, what time did the tornado first hit Colfax, and how long did it last?
It actually hit at 7:07 p.m. that day, and it was only in town a few minutes. So as the storm had brewed, there was like three smaller tornadoes that started over by Baldwin-Woodville area. And as it moved east, they all kind of merged together to making the one big F5 that actually hit Colfax. And it came in on the southwest corner of Colfax and kind of cut across the southern portion of the town and then exited it on the northeast corner.
And Michelle, the scope of the damage and just the sheer power of this weather event is really incredible. The photos certainly tell a lot of really amazing stories. There is a photo in the book. I believe it's a water tank that's used to give water to cattle that was way up in a tree, basically embedded in the tree.
Well, there were pictures like that. There were the straw through windows. There was, you know, just so much debris. And I think it was just something that was so unimaginable. And we've never lived through anything like that. And to have people, you know, years later share their stories and to be able to document and preserve their stories, I think, is so powerful.
We're talking with Troy and Michelle Knutson. They are the authors of the book, The 1958 Colfax Tornado, about a tremendous weather event in Colfax, Wisconsin. I was so amazed at how many photos you two have in the book. They are credited to a wide range of people and other things like the public library and yourselves. How did you accumulate all of these images?
Well, it's just a matter of talking to people. I mean, I spend a lot of time at the nursing home. And now that I've been doing this so many years, you're kind of at the point where they come to you. I mean, we jokingly will probably go home tonight and there may be a box of stuff on our front porch. People just drop items off because they know that we collect and preserve and save this stuff. And so we're kind of to the point where they come to us with it.
So, Michelle, Colfax was a pretty small community. How many people lost their lives in this tragedy?
They were about 1,000 people around the time, and, you know, it spanned a good distance. And within Colfax, I think 12 people were killed.
And it was a range of ages, I believe, from as young as a small child to someone in their later years.
Yes, and there was a baby that was hurt but survived, and, yes, a mother and a daughter. And, you know, to just think about those stories to a couple of guys who are driving in their car, you know, to just kind of think about what it means to keep their story alive, to know that they were just kind of in the wrong place at the wrong time when the weather hit, and to know that they're not forgotten.
And certainly there were some people who were not able to or didn't want to rebuild in the community who left, but many, many stayed. And it was a huge effort by people in the community and also people who came from elsewhere to help. How did the community come together and really rebuild itself, Troy?
Well, I would say, I mean, that's just how small-town America typically works. When there's an issue, everyone pitches in, and there were people that after the storm had hit and left, there was already the sound of chainsaws going of people clearing the way so they could get the roads open to get the ambulances, or there were, I guess there weren't ambulances, but they used people's cars to transport people to hospitals. But it's just, I don't know. That's how those small towns work. You know, everyone chips in, and you look out for your neighbor, and they look out for you. And
but it's so neat how we keep hearing stories about how people from communities, you know, 10, 20, 100 miles away heard about the storm, and they come in with their chainsaws. You know, they get in their cars, they gather up their friends. And it seems like, you know, on the weekly, we hear new stories. And there are some family connections, and there are some just people who decided to come into the community to help out. And that is just a beautiful, beautiful testament to small town life.
Michelle, are there memories that are preserved today in any kind of monument or other ways in Colfax?
We have Troy organized like a commemoration, and there is a bench in our Tower Park that has the names of all of the people that were killed from Colfax, just to remember, you know, who they were, or at least their names if we don't even know who they were. I think that's part of the book that was really important to us, too. I mean, we don't have a lot of people's stories, but to know that their names are out there and that their memory is preserved, not only in the book, but also in the park and within the community.
Well, Michelle and Troy, thank you so much for joining us, and thanks for the really fascinating book.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Troy and Michelle Knutson are the authors of the book, The 1958 Colfax Tornado, which is part of the series Images of America. They joined us from our studio in Eau Claire. Coming up, we'll look at the growing trend of granting legal rights to nature. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Coming up tomorrow after 6:30 on the morning show, a new report shows that nearly a dozen rural Wisconsin hospitals have stopped delivering babies in the last decade. Kate Archer-Kent and her guest examine why this trend is rising and the challenges rural hospitals face. That's tomorrow at 6:30 on the Ideas Network. Now, cities, indigenous tribes, and countries around the world have given nature and specific natural resources legal rights, or the rights of personhood. That has some environmentalists cheering and opponents of expanding legal rights in that way seeing red. But what does it even mean to have legal rights if you're a river or a forest or the air? Craig Kaufman is Associate Professor of Political Science and Environmental Studies at the University of Oregon. He's also a member of the United Nations Knowledge Network on Harmony with Nature. Craig, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So what does it mean to give natural resources legal rights or rights of personhood?
Well, first, I want to just clarify that the rights are typically given to ecosystems. And so it may seem like a small change in verbiage, but it's actually important conceptually, and it's important to understand for understanding why people might care about this. That is to say, in the philosophy underlying the law, the elements that receive rights are not just seen as individual stocks of resources, but rather are complex nested living ecosystems whose parts are all interconnected in ways that humans don't fully comprehend, but that humans are dependent on these ecosystems like ocean ecosystems, river ecosystems, lake ecosystems, forests, for everything that we need for life, from clean air, water, to food.
So, for instance, if a river, like, for instance, I know that there is a very significant river in New Zealand that has been given this kind of designation, it's not just the river, i.e. the water, it's everything that relies on it.
Correct. Yeah, it's the watershed is the parlance that scientists would use, right? So it's not just the water. It's all of the living elements that live in the watershed, which is a geographic area, from where the water collects to where it flows out to the ocean. And that's seen as a single living entity. And we can talk about the specific right. Different laws will recognize different rights. And so that's one of the things that's interesting to look at is the variation of the rights that are recognized and the impacts of that. So I don't know if you want to go into that now or.
Yeah, let's talk about what it means in reality if, as you said, an ecosystem is granted some kind of rights. How are those rights expressed or used?
Yeah, there's really two kind of models. So what's interesting about this is the rights of nature phenomenon is the result of simultaneous separate, you know, grassroots movements that have emerged around the world responding to common pressures. But because they're experimenting in their own, you know, national cultures and political and economic systems, the rights get expressed somewhat differently in different places. So in some places like Ecuador or the United States, there's really three main sort of fundamental rights. One is just the right to exist. That is to say, it has the right not to be destroyed. A second is that it has the right to continue existing. That is to say, to maintain its natural cycles that allow it to function. So, for example, watersheds would have the right to continue producing water. And then the right to be restored if damaged. And the last one is important because it doesn't mean that that humans can't impact the land. It just means that if humans do impact the land, that to the point where the ability of the ecosystem to function and exist may be threatened, that humans have the responsibility of restoring the ecosystem to a point where it can survive and function naturally. Those are the most common rights expressed.
And what happens, for instance, if the rights of an ecosystem, as you said, are violated? If someone violates my rights in some way, one of the ways that I can look for a redress is to take them to court. How would a river, for instance, file a complaint against someone?
Yeah, so really what you're asking is who speaks for the river.
Exactly.
Right? There are different, it's been set up different ways in different countries. So think of different guardianship mechanisms. But again, there's kind of two models. So one model that's been used in Ecuador is to say that anybody has the ability to speak on behalf of the river if they see that its rights are being violated. So essentially they're removing, you know, or they're removing restrictions to legal standing. But nobody is obliged then under that system to speak for the river. So you're just hoping that people will step up. A different model, which was used in New Zealand and some other places, is to appoint specific guardians who not only have the authority to speak or represent the interests and advocate for the interests of the ecosystem, whether it's a forest or a river, but have the obligation to do so. And they have the obligation to do so not just in court after the fact, after damage has been done, but to do so preemptively. That is to say, for example, have a seat at the table in decision-making policy forums where land management or land use decisions are being made so that the rights of the ecosystem can be taken into consideration up front, so that you can hopefully prevent the violations that would require you to go to court. And so the first system is more a reactive legalistic model, if you will. And the second one is less legalistic and more proactive in just incorporating rights of nature into the original decision-making body. And the hope is that you wouldn't have to go to courts then.
We're talking with Craig Kaufman right now. He's Associate Professor of Political Science and Environmental Studies at the University of Oregon. We're talking about the growing trend of providing legal rights to natural resources. And Craig, how long has this concept been around?
The concept's been around for ages. So in many non-Western societies, it goes back centuries, if not millennia. But even in Western cultures, it goes back at least to the 60s and 70s, right? So in the United States, 1972, a lawyer named Christopher Stone wrote a now fairly famous book, Should Trees Have Legal Standing? And it was written in response to a lawsuit where the Sierra Club was suing the Disney Corporation to try to prevent the building of a Disney resort in a high mountain valley. And the problem, the court was sympathetic to the arguments of the Sierra Club, but the problem was the court said the Sierra Club didn't have standing because the Sierra Club wasn't itself harmed. And a lot of lawyers, and including Supreme Court Justice Douglas at the time, because this went all the way to the Supreme Court, argued that that was unsatisfactory, that there are a lot of parts of the world that are important for their own sake, but including for humans, but that if they got damaged, it would be hard to show that any particular person was directly harmed. And so that was seen as a hole in the legal code that needed to be fixed. And so you start to have lawyers and judges thinking about maybe we should give legal standing to ecosystems.
At first glance, it might seem that this is new legal ground, but legal rights that are equivalent to that of people have been granted to other non-human entities already, right?
Sure. No, absolutely. So our legal system already grants legal personhood status and rights. We treat all kinds of non-living, non-human things as if they were people legally, corporations, trusts, estates, marine vessels and ships and so forth. So the idea that we would, you know, grant legal personhood status and rights to a non-living entity really isn't radical. I mean, that exists all the time. The question is, do we value ecosystems that provide clean air, clean water, food, other things that we need for life as much as we value, say, corporations and their property rights?
Can you give us some specific examples, especially here in the U.S., I think, so that we might be able to relate to it a little more easily, of places or groups who have pursued this on behalf mm-hmm. of natural resources?
Yeah. So again, I want to keep emphasizing it's not natural resources, right? Because the logic is we want to get away from thinking of nature as just a set of independent stocks of resources that if you just mm-hmm. use one, it's going to have no effect on the system. And that, of course, just isn't true any more than the human body is just a collection of biological resources, right? There are systems where if I took away my heart, that would have important effects for the rest of the system. Mm-hmm. So the same thing goes with the ecosystem. So in the United States, there are now 47 communities around the country that have adopted municipal ordinances recognizing rights of nature. And a common story is this. What's interesting to me about the U.S. phenomenon is that it's not being propelled by environmentalists, principally. And the Toledo Lake Erie example is a good example of this. A common scenario is that, increasingly pressures on the ecosystem from industrial extraction and other things is just getting to the point where it's really negatively affecting the health of families. And just concerned parents are realizing that they need to do something. And so their initial response is to just assume that, hey, if an outside a fracking company, for example, that engages in hydraulic fracturing, comes in and injects the fracking wastewater into the only drinking water system and spoils the only available drinking water, a lot of local communities assume that they should be able to have a say in whether or not their drinking water source is destroyed or not. And then they are quickly surprised to learn that the law doesn't actually give them any rights to protect their families. And so they are coming to the realization that the existing environmental laws and existing human rights laws have proven inadequate to protect communities and families from the kind of environmental degradation that's starting to affect the health and well-being of their families. And so increasingly many communities are coming to the conclusion that they just need to start changing laws. Recognizing rights of nature isn't the only way that you could fix laws. It's just one that's common. And I could give you some rationale. Do we have time to get into a the rationale for why communities, sure, why rights of nature can help boost community rights.
Absolutely.
Because in the United States, this is an important point. The rights of nature laws in the United States are being propelled by community rights activists, because the common scenario is that, you know, if a community finds that diseases or, you know, incidences of cancer or access to drinking water or, you know, other problems are skyrocketing as a result of injection of sewage sludge or hydraulic fracturing waste or what have you, and they go to court and say, hey, we've been harmed, we want to try to prevent this harmful behavior, it's really difficult for them to get legal standing to be able to protect themselves in court. Because just the burden of proof to show that you were that there was a direct link from the industrial activity that caused the environmental degradation was specifically responsible for, say, your husband's cancer or your child's, you know, disease or what have you. And so legally, it's very difficult to protect yourself. And of course, the law doesn't really protect or recognize community rights. It just protects corporate rights, property rights. And so the advantage of structuring these around rights of nature is that if you recognize an ecosystem that you depend on as a legal person with rights, much like you would recognize a corporation as a legal person with rights, and then you establish the community as the guardians who have the ability to speak on behalf of the ecosystem, it's quite easy scientifically to show a direct link between an industrial activity and a degradation of the functioning of an ecosystem. And then the community can better protect its rights by virtue of being the guardian for the ecosystem. And so because of this, what's interesting to me is there are a number of cases in the United States where these rights of nature laws are occurring in states that are red states, you know, that are not by communities that don't particularly consider themselves environmentalists. They're just trying to protect their communities.
We're talking about the movement to grant legal rights to nature. Craig Kaufman is Associate Professor of Political Science and Environmental Studies at the University of Oregon. He's also a member of the United Nations Knowledge Network on Harmony with Nature. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What do you think of these efforts? Do you think that nature needs to be protected in this way? Or do you think that it's a bad approach that could have significant drawbacks? If you're in favor of it, is there an aspect of nature or an ecosystem that you would like to see given this protection? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation in just a bit here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. We're continuing our conversation about movements to give nature legal rights or personhood under the law. It's been put in place in a variety of cities, countries, and Native nations. Craig Kaufman is with us. He's an associate professor of political science and environmental studies at the University of Oregon. He's also a member of the United Nations Knowledge Network on Harmony with Nature. And Craig, is this approach, this trend, seen as a tactic tied to concerns about, for instance, global warming and other large-scale natural crises?
Absolutely. In fact, I'd say there's really this movement is being pushed both by the bottom up, by grass movements of communities around the world who, as I said before, are just looking for new pathways to deal with the intensified pressures on the environment that affects their health and well-being of their families. But at the same time, it's being propelled from the top down by policymakers and governments who recognize that we have a closing window of opportunity to deal with a number of environmental crises, both climate change as well as extensive biodiversity loss, and that we need radical system change to do that. So your listeners may remember that just last March, I believe it was, the United Nations Scientific Panel charged with studying the science of biodiversity issued a report warning that human actions was causing essentially a sixth extinct mass extinction, extensive loss of species around the world, as many as 1 million species. And that, you know, just a few months earlier than that, the scientific panel on climate change, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, released its report showing that the worst effects of climate change we'll start to see as early as 2040, right? So this isn't decades away. This is, you know, in certainly in our lifetimes. And that, so the science is quite clear. The current economic system, the current legal and governance systems are just unsustainable in the very literal sense of being able to unsustain the functioning of the ecosystems that we depend on for survival. And it's not too late to take action, but the window of opportunity is closing, and we're going to need dramatic transformation in our systems. And so the idea behind Rights of Nature, it's just one strategy for how you would structure legally a new kind of legal and governance systems that makes human activity consistent with the laws of nature, that is to say, the laws of how natural ecosystems actually function.
Let's go to the phones, and Pat in Duluth, Minnesota is there. Hi, Pat.
Hi. I had not heard of this idea before, but I totally love that on many levels. But a practical one right now that I'm experiencing in Duluth, there's a green corridor that goes down towards Lake Superior, and it has been developed in the past, parts of it. It is somewhat fragmented, but not a lot. But there's a golf course now that the city doesn't want to support, and none of the elected officials are talking about anything other than development. And I look around and I see the scientific papers from all over the world, really, that are talking about climate change and the need to save the green space, to replant trees. And I just think how backward thinking we are, just giving it away to the development process.
Thank you so much for that call, Pat. And Craig, we're running a little short on time. I wanted to ask you if there has been opposition or challenges to these types of conditions giving nature legal rights.
Absolutely, of course. Anytime you're talking about changes in, again, the end goal is not to have the rights per se. The end goal is to prevent human activities that are going to destroy the ecosystems on which human life depends, right? And so there are, of course, organizations and individuals that benefit from the status quo, and they're fiercely resisting.
And have they been successful in challenging it, for instance, in court?
Certainly. Well, so in the United States, in the United States, it's early. This is kind of getting into the weeds a bit. Because we have a federal system, because not a lot of legislation happens from through the national legislature, that's why this is happening in piecemeal fashion at the grassroots through municipal ordinances. It takes a while for this jurisprudence to develop, because it's based on a different philosophy of law than most lawyers and judges are trained in. And so in Ecuador, for example, Ecuador is a good example because it was the first to make a really strong law, put it in the Constitution. And it took several years for judges to fully understand how to interpret the constitutional provisions. But now that it's been a decade past, we've seen judges learn how to do that, and they have been interpreting it in a way that I think more effectively balances property rights and the rights of nature.
And Craig, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for being with us. Craig Kaufman is Associate Professor of Political Science and Environmental Studies at the University of Oregon. He was with us to talk about the trend of giving natural nature legal rights. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, the Trump administration has set new guidelines for kidney treatment and transplant. We'll find out what to watch for and how to keep our kidneys healthy. That and much more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show. Tomorrow after 7, about two-thirds of Americans believe our government keeps important information secret that it could safely release. That's according to a new Pew Research Center report. Kate Archer-Kent and her guests explore our confidence in government and each other and what that means for our nation. That's tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Coming up next, it's the news from NPR and WPR, and then we'll hear how harassment and hate are shaping the experiences of online gamers across the country and what can be done about it. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, in for Rob Ferret. This is Central Time.